Talking today with Dan Wallach, professor of computer science at Rice University. He's been doing a lot of research on the effect and security of electronic voting machines. Dan, as you know, there was recently a study done by some Princeton professors about the Diebold voting machines and how one could compromise them and change or affect the votes that are recorded on them. Can you tell me a little bit more about that and, you know, kind of give me a bottom line as to how concerned people who use those machines should be about them?
So what the Princeton study did was they were able to get themselves an actual Diebold voting system, basically the same as the ones that are used in Maryland and Georgia and several other states. And what they figured out was that when poll workers are operating Diebold voting systems, there are memory cards that they move around to collect the results at the end of the day. And what they found was that they could actually create a virus that would spread from one machine to the next by virtue of that memory card moving around. This is analogous to the days before the internet when viruses could spread on floppies from one computer to another. And they basically figured out they could do that with Diebold voting systems. And the reason why that's significant is that you only need to infect one machine. So you compromise one machine, and then the infection can spread throughout the entire county.
Now, how does the infection spread? I mean, are these machines networked to each other?
So the machines are not networked like on the internet, but the memory cards are moved from machine to machine to collect the results, to install the ballot definitions. Because there's no network, all the data is copied back and forth on these memory cards. So because the memory cards move back and forth, the virus actually infects the memory card and uses the memory card to infect the machine.
Okay, so but you would still need physical access to a machine or at least to a memory card in order to install this virus.
And the interesting thing is in many counties, and this varies from county to county, it's common practice to deliver the voting machines ahead of time. So they might be locked into the church basement or the school cafeteria at night, or they might in some cases be stored in somebody's house. This is sometimes called the sleepover voting problem. And if somebody can get physical access to even one machine beforehand, then again the infection can spread to other machines.
Okay. Now, just because a professor was able to do this, doesn't necessarily mean that it will be practical in the real world. It's a proof of concept, but a lot of things for which there's proof of concept never really develop, if you will, into a viable commercial product. So, you know, how theoretical a result is this, and how worried should people be?
I think the impact of this, of the Princeton study, was showing that it was feasible, and showing that it was fairly easy to do. So the question becomes now, given that you know that they're flying by the seat of their pants without any kind of protection, that it's so easy for this to occur, what steps should we take to mitigate against the risk that somebody might try to do such an attack in practice?
Well, you read my mind. That's my next question.
So, what should we do? One thing that we could do, I mean, between now and November 7, you don't want to rock the boat too heavily. You could replace the possibility of things going wrong with a certainty that nobody would have any idea what they were doing because you changed the rules at the very late in the game. So you need to split, when we talk about mitigation, we need to talk about between now and November and November and thereafter. In the short term, what we need to talk about are improvements to procedures and policies to try to minimize the risk. We shouldn't ever have memory cards or machines held in the sole custody of a single person. That's something that we can do between now and November. We can change procedures to make sure that there's never any time that any one person has sole custody of a voting machine or of a memory card. That's something that you can, and you should do that not just for Diebold gear, but for gear from any vendor, because the same risks potentially apply.
Well, you could do that for people still using paper machines for the same reason.
So the reason why paper is different is, so I don't know what you mean by paper machines, but there are...
there's still places where they do like optical scan, where you fill in like a Scantron kind of thing and they run it through an optical scanner.
Right, so there's two different kinds of optical scan machines. There's central count, where you have one big tabulating device at the election central. And then there's precinct count, where the scanner is actually bolted to the top of the ballot box. When it's central count, then it's easier to maintain custody over the machine because it's locked in a warehouse with video cameras and locks and, you know, you can procedurally control that. When you have precinct count scanners, now you have the scanner that's out in the field and you have, again, the risk that somebody could tamper with the scanner. But because you have the paper, if for whatever reason you don't trust the scanner's tabulation, you can go back and retabulate the paper, either mechanically or by hand.
Or you could inspect the ballots and see if there's any evidence that a vote has been changed or invalidated or whatever.
Right. So the way you could look at it is the existence of the paper that was marked by the voters mitigates against the risk that the electronic tabulation might be an error.
So therefore, long-term, the long-term mitigation for your Diebold machines, you would recommend including paper ballots on them, a printer to print out a paper ballot.
So I've been advocating this position for years, that if you're going to have electronic voting, then the voting machine should produce a paper record. Let's not call it a receipt, because you're not allowed to take it home with you. That paper record is your vote. It's your ballot. It should go in a ballot box. It should be saved. It should be recountable, etc.
So in other words, does that mean that you believe the electronic machines should be really nothing more than the interface, and that it doesn't actually record a vote, or it only records it for backup purposes? The printer, the printed ballot that results is the vote.
So the answer to your question varies by state. So in Colorado, the electronic records count on election night, but if there's ever a recount, then the paper record becomes the record that you're supposed to go to first. So I don't know exactly what the Texas rules are, because Texas doesn't have any voting machines that have both electronic and paper records. And so they'll have to make new rules.
I guess my question is, which would you advocate if and when Texas does make such a new rule?
So the rule should say that when there's doubt, the paper takes priority. But let's say you're in a scenario where the paper gets destroyed through some kind of an accident, or you have evidence that the paper was tampered with. The ballots were stuffed after the fact. If you have reason to doubt the paper, and there's plenty of reasons that could exist, then in circumstances like that, perhaps the electronic records would be better. Likewise, there might be circumstances where you have reason to believe the electronic records have been tampered with. So the way to think about it is to pretend you're an auditor, and you're auditing Enron or some other firm, and you're trying to make the books add up. And when you have double entry bookkeeping, you have potentially two separate ways of coming to the same total. And if you find an error in one, maybe you're more willing to trust the other. So what you really need are procedures that take, it's good to have redundant records. And not just redundant records like we have three different copies recorded in the same machine. That's not really redundancy. Redundancy is one on paper and one in electronic, where they have different failure modes, they have different threats. The way that you tamper with paper votes is different from the way you tamper with electronic votes. And by having these kinds of redundant records, you increase the likelihood that you can convince yourself what the proper answer is.
Okay. We've been talking primarily about the Diebold machines, because that's what the study was on. But Harris County, and indeed I believe most if not all of Texas, uses the Hart InterCivic eSlate machines. How secure are they? I mean, has anyone found a gaping flaw like your colleagues at Princeton did for the Diebold machines that would affect the eSlates?
So, to the best of my knowledge, no researchers have been able to get a hold of a Hart InterCivic machine and study it independently. So the best answer I can tell you for the Hart InterCivic machine is we don't know yet. There was a lawsuit in Colorado where I was an expert witness. This is Conroy versus Dennis. And in that case, I was able to read a lot of Hart InterCivic's filings, what they send to the state, and what the independent testing authorities. When they say a voting machine is certified, that means an independent testing authority has looked it over and written a report. So I've read those reports with respect to the Hart InterCivic machine. And what I read raised many more questions than gave answers. So, for example, Hart has this new security feature called an ECM, which stands for some, I forget what it stands for, but basically it's a little cryptographic USB token that they use in addition to passwords. And when I was reading the user manual for it, it described a procedure you could use for making copies of these cryptographic security token keys. Now, I don't know exactly how they implemented it. I don't know if they did the crypto well or not. But I can tell you if there's a procedure to make a copy, then that would be a procedure that somebody who wanted to tamper with them would probably follow. So is that a real threat, or is that just a question mark raised by reading the documentation? I don't really know yet. It's certainly a question mark, and the state of Colorado did not have enough evidence to answer the question. And I did some more digging for state of Texas, and at least based on public documents, Texas doesn't know any better either. We're just taking the vendor's word for it.
Okay. The thing about taking the vendor's word for it, of course, is that, well, I mean, they are quite incentivized to put a happy face on all possible security threats. I mean, if you had the opportunity, what questions would you ask Hart InterCivic, and what would you want from them to reassure you that they've done things right?
So what I would like to do is to be able to examine the entire system myself, to be able to read their source code and to be able to do what is sometimes called a tiger team or a red team analysis, where the goal is, given full access to the system, see if you can derive a way to break it. And if you can, then that goes into your report. And these kinds of analyses have been conducted by other states like Maryland, Ohio, and California. And whenever they've been done, they find problems. And that helps inform the policymakers to say, this is a problem, then you need to require the vendor to fix it. And generally they do.
So you're saying that some states have been better at due diligence on this than others?
Absolutely.
Which states have done the best job?
Well, probably the most comprehensive work has happened in California. The California Secretary of State was very concerned about some particular issues with the way Diebold used a basic interpreter inside of its voting machines. And because
a basic interpreter?
Yeah, in fact, they wrote their own basic interpreter. They use it for printing out reports. And so the Secretary of State of California commissioned two professors and an independent security expert. So this is Dave Wagner from UC Berkeley, Matt Bishop from UC Davis, and David Jefferson from Lawrence Livermore. And the three of them were commissioned to do a detailed examination of just this particular AccuBasic interpreter. And they wrote two reports, one that all of us could read, that was exceptionally detailed and provided a laundry list of important problems. But what it didn't have was, here's exactly what you need to do to exploit the flaw. They left that for a second report that's not public. And that's, so from the public policy perspective, the report that they wrote, well, it left no mistake about the severity of the issues they found, yet it didn't leave a roadmap for somebody to exploit those issues later. That's exactly the sort of analysis that has not been done on the Hart InterCivic machine. And not just to pick on Hart, but this sort of analysis hasn't been done for ESNS, it hasn't been done for Sequoia, it hasn't been done for a variety of other machines.
Which machine, if any, would you say has had the most thorough examination done on it?
Probably the broadest scrutiny has been applied to Diebold machines.
Because they're the ones that are for which there's the most suspicion, I guess.
Well, and because Diebold accidentally left its source code online a couple years ago, that's how I was able to analyze it and write a report with several of my colleagues in 2004. We found problems. And since then, a number of other people have been beating up on Diebold. And you know, Diebold has deserved all the punches they've got, and not as much scrutiny has been applied to the other vendors, and needs to be.
Okay. Get back to the Eastlights for a moment. Your students, as a project every year, they try to do, you know, to come up with a way of compromising the Eastlate machines. Tell me more about that.
Well, so since we can't get actual Hart InterCivic equipment, you know, they don't want to give it to us, we wrote our own voting machine, It's the small 2,000-line Java program. We titled it Hackavote.
Okay.
And this is an assignment to the graduate students in my security course. So phase one of the assignment is be evil. So we're saying you're an employee of the Hackavote Corporation and you wish to influence the outcome of an election using Hackavote equipment. So what your assignment is to do minimal changes to the voting machine that would enable you to compromise the election later, with the caveat that you know somebody will be reading over your changes and trying to figure them out, which means you need to make your changes subtle and small enough that somebody auditing the source code might miss them. That's phase one of the assignment. And the students will eat it up, because you're giving them a controlled environment where they can have sinister thoughts.
Right.
Kids love it, and they work absolute overtime and are brilliantly creative in what they come up with. So phase two, I take the assignments from students and swap them with other students. And now I put them, and now their responsibility is to audit each other's code. And so they're looking for what their peers did. So, and now they take on the role of a certifying authority, the Secretary of State or the independent testing authorities. And they have the flip side of the role. And you know, they think there might be something suspicious in there, but they don't know what it is, and they have to go figure it out.
Okay. How successful do they tend to be?
Amazingly, students will... So every student project is audited by two groups. And there are often cases where one or the other group will miss something. I mean, most students find most things, but not all. But some things slip through. In fact, there have even been cases where students found a problem in the original voting machine as we gave it to them in the first place. Huh. So for phase one, they did nothing. They submitted the voting machine as is.
Wow.
Because they didn't need to modify it because they already knew a way to attack it.
That's pretty interesting. Again, though, I guess the question comes down to, you know, how much would this depend on physical access to the machines? In your case, you're talking about, you know, a commercially available product, which, you know, claims to be secure, and we've got someone, you know, putting a backdoor or whatever into it. You know, even if that person were an employee of the company that provided the voting machine, would not that employee still need a way to get at the data later?
So here's the issue. I mean, I'm not accusing any of these companies of malice, but what if they had an employee who was malicious? So if that employee could make a change to the software, it's entirely plausible that very subtle changes to the software might go sailing through the certification process and then would be the legitimate software that would be legitimately installed by the counties.
And from that point, you just don't know what could happen, is what you're saying.
So, you know, our students have found subtle ways with our own voting machine where they could, you know, if you gave it the right series of subtle clicks, suddenly the machine would be under your control. So imagine if there was a slot machine in Vegas where you could walk up and you issue a funny series of bets and suddenly you get a huge payout.
It's kind of like that, is what you're saying.
So if somebody were to do that to a real voting system, it's entirely possible, given what we know about the certification process, that it would never be noticed and it would go sailing right through.
Right. So what you're saying is that the biggest things we have to fear right now is not what we know, but what we don't know.
Right. So what we do... Okay, here's what we know. We know that the voting machine vendors, by and large, are very lax in their attention to detail with computer security. Many of them make stunning rookie errors, and you know, things that, you know, if you'd taken my security course, you wouldn't even think to do some of these things that they're all doing as standard course. And not just in America. I mean, there was a Dutch voting machine where some Dutch hackers figured out how to compromise the machine, and they had it playing chess with them. So it's not just an American problem. The companies who are building these machines are just not very sophisticated about how they're doing it. So that's issue one. Issue two is that the certification and testing of the machines seems to be woefully inadequate. It's one thing to test something where, okay, if the standard says you have to drop it 3 feet onto concrete and it better not break, that's easy to test. You pick it up, you drop it, and either it works or it doesn't. But if the standard says that you shouldn't be able to install malicious software on it, how do you test that? How do you convince yourself they got it right? And as best we can tell, none of the independent testing authorities have any competence at testing these machines for any of the important security criteria that we care about.
Why is that? I mean, you say that a lot of these companies are bad at this. Is it because they're more about the voter interface, which I think got most of the attention after the 2000 election debacle? Or is it just that, I don't know, that, well, what is it? I don't even know what the alternative would be.
All I can guess is that the standards are very vague. The standards to which the machines are certified have these very broad statements. You know, the machine must not be subject to tampering with its software. Great. And beyond that, it's entirely up to the discretion of the testing authority to interpret that. And all the evidence we have suggests that the testing authorities are incredibly lax in their interpretation.
Okay.
So how do we improve that? Well, you know, what that means is that if the state of Texas actually cares about tamper resistance, you can't just count on the ITAs. The state of Texas would need to apply a more stringent standard on its own. And right now, the state of Texas doesn't do anything of the sort.
We'll come back to that in a minute. As you know, in the primaries this year, there were a couple of situations where there were big problems. Up in Tarrant County, some votes were counted multiple times initially on election day. And down in Webb County, there were problems where the vote count was delayed because of some issues with the voting machine. Tell me a little bit more about that, and, you know, where did the problem lie?
So I probably know more about Webb County. I was an expert witness in some lawsuits there as well. So this is Laredo, Texas. There was one of the judicial primary races. This is two Democrats running for a judicial office, Flores versus Lopez. That race was decided by about 100 votes out of roughly 50,000. That's 0.2%. And so I was brought in by the guy who was on the losing side, Manuel Flores, and was given access to all sorts of records, and they said, see what you can find. What we found were a wide variety of problems. We found one machine that was cleared at 3:30 p.m. on election day. So maybe some votes were lost from that machine, maybe not. We found that there were 26 machines that had test votes, like one Republican, one Democrat. You know, Webb County is almost entirely Democrat. So when you have all these machines that each have one Democrat and one Republican vote, and each for precisely the same set of candidates, that looks a whole lot like test votes, not like actual live election votes. So that actually gave 27 votes of that 100-vote margin to the guy who won.
Okay, so in other words, those are machines that weren't actually used, but were just sort of warmed up and ready for use, is what you're saying.
They were tested in advance, and it's good to do testing in advance to make sure that, and this is sometimes called logic and accuracy testing. You cast a handful of votes for each candidate, you add them up and make sure that that's what you expect.
Sure.
But they actually showed up in the real election tallies.
Right. So, like I said, either those machines weren't used or they didn't actually record the votes. And I mean, since this was a primary, none of these should have been recording one Republican and one Democrat anyway, because it should have been one or the other.
Well, I mean, in a primary, you might have a Republican voter who comes in and votes on the machine as a Republican, and then a Democrat who comes in and votes on the machine as a Democrat. The machines can do that.
Okay.
So that the issue is not that the issue is that we have evidence that suggests that test votes were counted towards the real election, and the test votes were all in favor of one of the two candidates.
Right. Right. So again, it seems to come back to procedural issues, though.
Right. So we have all kinds of issues of procedures going haywire. So there's an issue called a fleeing voter, where the voter doesn't complete their vote, but they run away, or they forget to hit the cast ballot button before they're done. So the official procedure is supposed to be, for these are machines from a company called ES&S, that there's an override cancel that a poll worker can do. You're not supposed to cast the vote halfway through. You're supposed to cancel the whole thing. Now, we can argue whether that's an appropriate procedure, but for now, let's just take it on faith that that's okay, that we're canceling somebody's half-finished vote. So there was supposed to have been a paper log written by the poll workers explaining the circumstances around which they canceled a vote. And there were, I forget the exact number, some large number of canceled votes without any paper logs anywhere indicating what happened and why.
By large enough to have swung that election?
Certainly large enough to raise some interesting questions.
Okay.
I mean, what ended up happening was the two parties settled with each other out of court. So the lawsuit vaporized before it ever got in front of a judge.
Okay. Let's talk a little bit about what should be done. If you were given the power tomorrow to design the electronic voting system for Harris County and the state of Texas, what would you do?
So I need to give the answer in three parts.
Fine.
Between now and November 7, the answer is better procedures. After November 7, we need to talk about retrofits to the machines to improve them. And that's some kind of paper trail attachment. The paper trail attachments that the vendors are presently offering for sale, by and large, are crap. They have the votes being recorded on a continuous spool of paper, which means that once you get access to the spool of paper, you have the votes in the order that they're cast. And it's on flimsy thermal paper, the same thermal paper that you get from a gas station, you know, pump. And you leave those on your dashboard and they turn brown. That's not something you want to use for archival records, particularly in a place like Texas where it gets hot here. Even in November, we could have 90 degree days and it could get to 120, 130 degrees inside the car where you're transporting those ballots easy, maybe even hotter. So that's just not acceptable for something that's meant to be a ballot. That's a permanent record of how people voted. So, but getting the vendors to buy better printers, that's something that we could get in place between now and 2008. So the third part of the answer to your question is after 2008, we could start, you know, we could mandate now more stringent design for a machine and require that post 2008. So we could tell the vendors, telegraph to them in advance that by 08 or maybe by 010, that these present machines aren't going to cut it anymore. And the standards that far out are going to be much more stringent. And here's what they are. Get cracking.
Okay. Let's talk a little bit specifically. What procedures would you like to see changed, added, or removed?
The big procedure is all about custody of the machines and custody of the memory cards. The present procedures are they different from county to county, and they're not, there isn't a focus on this notion of dual chain of custody. You never want any voting machine or any memory card held in the custody of one person, ever. That's the first procedural change. The second thing I would do is get rid of modems entirely. Right now in Harris County, what they do is the results go from the individual precincts to a handful of these regional centers where they collect them together and then they communicate them back to Election Central. And while they don't use the internet, they're still using some kind of telecommunication system, which means, you know, some sort of modem system. And as far as we can tell, none of the vendors have the slightest clue how to do security over a modem. Because the certification has allowed blindingly dumb things to get through. And so even though they tell us, oh, we use cryptography and we do all these security things, we have no evidence to suggest they do it right. And irrespective of whether they do the crypto properly, the computers on the receiving end, you know, when you dial in from a modem, there's a computer answering the phone. And those computers that are answering the phone, as far as we can tell, are just ordinary Windows computers. And ordinary Windows computers have a wide variety of security problems. And so somebody wanting to attack an election here in Harris County might just dial into those very same modem lines and then be able to attack the computers in Election Central. It's an unacceptable risk, and I'd rather see people sitting in the back of the car, you know, a Democrat on the left seat, a Republican in the right seat, and the memory cards and a Ziploc bag between the two of them where they can both watch it, driving to downtown Houston to Election Central. That's how it ought to be done.
Okay. I guess the main objection some people would have to this is the cost and the amount of labor it might require. How practical are these suggestions?
So, saying that you should ban modems, that is not a high cost item. It means that some more people are going to log some more miles in their car. But that's cheap. Saying that you need to maintain dual custody at all times, it's a pain. It means that realistically you need to keep all the voting machines centrally and deliver them at the last possible minute, probably, you know, early in the morning.
And that would introduce a risk that some locations will not get their machine on time because of a traffic jam, a car breaking down, whatever.
But somehow we all get our newspapers in the morning. So delivering equipment in the morning to a large number of precincts, it could be done. Maybe you stage them at regional warehouses to get them closer. I mean, it's a tactical issue of, you know, how many trucks do you need, how many people do you need in the trucks, but it's not implausible. It's not rocket science to say that we can deliver voting machines to precincts in the morning.
Right. All right, so getting back to the third part of your answer,
The long term.
The long term. What specifically would you like to see written into the standards for the next generation of voting machines?
So we're talking about Texas standards or federal standards?
Well, let's just say Texas, but again, this is your ideal. How would you do it?
So the main problem is the present standards are trying to require the vendors to be a little bit better, and the vendors are all trying to weasel their way out of it. And the end result is just not working. What we need instead are requirements not just about the end result, but requirements about the whole process that goes into developing it in the first place. If you have developers building the machines who don't understand what they're doing, you know, garbage in, garbage out. So the standards need to start from the very conception of the machines through how they're evaluated, through how they're debugged. You need to require an entire development process, not just require that the artifact at the end of the day have certain properties.
Okay, again, specifically, give me some examples.
So rather than focusing on certain attributes, like you drop it 3 feet and it doesn't break, instead you need to focus on the threat. It needs to be resistant to, you know, somebody who has physical access for up to an hour, or it needs to be resistant to, you know, even if the software is malicious, that something needs to come out right. So you need to write, rather than standards for how it's built, you have to write standards for the threats. And then you have to have people who are certifying the systems who know how to implement those threats. People who know how to break things can then evaluate how robust a system is against those threats. So we could talk about much more specific technical measures and countermeasures that could or could not be taken. And it might be appropriate for the standards to say, if you want to build a paperless machine, then here's an astronomic standard you have to hit. Or you need to have paper to mitigate against some of these risks, and here's how that might go. Just talking to you today, I can't give you a concise idea of all the different features you'd need to have. Suffice to say that it needs to be a process rather than just an artifact. There needs to be a process in place where you have people continuously trying to break it and people thereby continuously trying to improve it.
How optimistic are you that we will get to that kind of process?
Hard to say. we have a process like that in aviation, and we have a process like that in most other places in our lives. When an airplane falls out of the sky, for starters, we know it. And then we have investigators who go in and say, why did this airplane fall out of the sky? And they painstakingly reconstruct what happened, and at the end, they come to a conclusion. The plane fell out of the sky because, and maybe there's a problem with one of the tail fins or something, and then they have access to the entire design of the aircraft. There's no trade secrets to the accident investigators. They can go and look at the design of the aircraft, and then they can say, okay, Boeing, you need to fix the tail of the 737 to be more robust against this particular failure mode, and then everybody who flies a 737 is required to upgrade their tail fins. And that's how it works. That's not how voting works. Right now, today, if you run an existing voting machine that's certified, if somebody finds a problem with it, it never gets decertified. So you can continue to run your known broken voting machine for as long as you want. So here in Texas, for ES&S, one of the major voting system vendors, everybody in Texas is using version 8.something of the ES&S software. Other states are running version 9.something. Version 8.something has 3-character passwords that, as far as I can tell, there's no way to change them, and they're easily guessed. I'm not going to say what they are, but they're really poorly chosen. Once you upgrade to version 9 of the software, you can actually change the passwords. But nobody in Texas is allowed to run version 9 of the software, even though it fixes a significant problem with version 8 of the software. Version 8 should be decertified, and then version 9 should have to go through the certification process. That hasn't happened yet. So any process that can allow old broken software to be running in favor of new, potentially less broken software is a broken process, and we need to fix that.
Okay. Is there anything else you'd like to add?
Well, I've been working on the voting issue since 2001, and the most astonishing thing from a computer scientist's perspective is how slow this world works. I mean, I've been working on this problem for 5 years, and hardly anything has changed. Whereas 5 years in internet time is forever.
Right.
And it's really astonishing to computer scientists. You were saying, here's an obvious solution to the problem. There, go fix it. And it hasn't happened yet. So computer scientists like me have had to learn how to hunker down and realize that this isn't a sprint, it's a marathon. And I'm going to be working on this issue for a long time.
Okay. Dan Wallach, thank you very much for talking to me, and good luck with your future research on this subject.
Always a pleasure.